Kamen, Securities and Exchange Commission versus Little. Mr. Greenberg.
May it please the court. My name is Paul Greenberg, and I represent the appellants Melvin Lytle and Paul Knight. This appeal involves the interplay of two settled principles of law. The first is that the issue of scienter.
Well, I don't understand about your. You haven't appealed all the charges against you, right? You haven't appealed all the rulings.
That's correct, Judge.
So what's different? If you prevailed on this appeal, what benefit would there be for your clients? Would that eliminate these penalties or what?
Yes, Judge, that's our view.
Is that the issue, the penalties? It'd still be injunctive relief?
Correct, Judge.
But the penalties depend on the penalties that you're appealing.
The penalties were predicated on the judge's ruling below that the defendants violated the anti-fraud provisions that were alleged.
Now, have any of the people involved in any of the defendants, former or current, been indicted?
Yes, Judge.
Which ones?
All of them.
All of them. So your clients have been indicted?
Defendants in this case have been indicted. Angela Eldridge has been indicted. Jack Montana has been indicted. There may be others. I don't know. Our involvement in the case began on appeal.
Okay. Thank you.
So the two issues are that summary judgment may only be entered against a defendant on the issue of scienter in the most extreme and exceptional cases. And the other undisputed principle of law is that it is the appellee's burden before this court to cite to evidence in the record to sustain the ruling of summary judgment on all the issues, but most importantly on the issue of scienter. In this case, the SEC relied exclusively on the district court's opinion. That is not what de novo review requires.
But the district court's opinion is very thorough, and the district court refers to facts in this record that are damning to your clients.
Well, that is the district court's interpretation, and importantly...
What's she wrong about? I mean, she talks about... There's a quote from this November 5, 1999 letter, for example, from Mr. Lytle to Mr. Montana, talking about this something that's going to create insurance for the client of 196% of the original deposit. Somehow or another, that's going to happen through the use of T-bills. This is a piece of evidence in the record, and there are many more. I just happened to open to that page.
Well,
what's wrong with that?
Well, what's wrong with it, Judge, is that the district court was selective in which facts she believed were important to write her opinion. The district court.
I guess I have trouble looking at the facts that the district court does rely on, which were in the presentations under the local rules that govern the way Rule 56 works, with the citations to the supporting materials in the record. Her conclusion is, in the end, no rational person could come to any conclusion but the fact that your client satisfied the scienter standard. I don't see in your theories anything that could allow, again, we're not supposed to imagine people from Mars. I mean, somebody who's looking at the record, how could they find anything but that?
Well, for starters, the district court did not allow for really any of the defendant's evidence. She erroneously concluded that because the defendants invoked the Fifth Amendment and refused to give deposition testimony, they were precluded somehow from offering any substantive assertions in support of their position.
In what form would such assertions take?
Well, the assertions are the ones that we have spelled out in this case. That
who spelled them out?
For instance, the defendant's position that the representations came from Angela Eldridge is directly testified to by the investors themselves. The investors testified that...
You're relying on the investors' testimony to establish that you didn't have knowledge?
I'm relying... The theory, the defendants, in our view, were pawns in this entire scenario. Eldridge,
how can anyone think that, given the amount of money they put in their own bank accounts?
Well, Judge, that also...
They're wealthy pawns.
That's right.
Judge, that gets back to your initial point. We don't believe that the evidence supports, in the record, supports the view that the money went directly into their accounts. What the vast and overwhelming majority of the money went...
What's the force of directly in that statement?
Well, the money generally...
It ended up there.
Well, the money went to Eldridge, either from the investors themselves directly or to the defendants, which was then wired to Eldridge. Now, if these defendants are looking to commit this grand fraud, why wouldn't they just keep the money?
Well, maybe they don't want to be that obvious. They're trying to keep things going, so it's a balancing act,
no,
I would assume.
But the government's position is that the defendants themselves were defrauded by Eldridge. They concede that point.
And
they
why said, is that so strange? I mean, I guess I looked at it and I thought, well, there's no honor among thieves.
Right.
You know, they're defrauding the investors, and then they turn the money over to Eldridge, and it turns out she winds up skimming, you know, lots of money off the top too, and everyone's cheating everyone else within this circle.
Well, again, the point here in our appeal is, at what point is it proper for the district court to say, in the words of this court, that the defendant's explanations were utterly implausible? And it's our position that in a case that is so rare in law to enter summary judgment on scienter, that the government is required to comply strictly with the procedural rules.
It's clear that that fraudulent statements were made to the investors, right? That's not in...
We do not dispute that, Judge.
Now, is it your contention that every single thing that your client said to the investors was merely a repetition of something that Eldridge had told them?
Yes, Judge.
That they didn't add anything to what
Correct,
she
Judge.
Told them?
Correct. Correct.
I don't think that's correct, but...
Well, that's our position, Judge. That is, based on the evidence in the record, we know that the defendants, Eldridge put on a dog and pony show for the defendants at private offices at DLJ. They had meetings in a private dining room at DLJ. They had every reason, when they wanted to invite clients, to impress upon the defendants that how powerful the connections were with DLJ. They believed that, and that's where the deal, and that's where they were convinced of the representations. You know, if we look at what's going on in the world today, you know, we have a subprime mortgage debacle where subprime loans that weren't worth the paper they were written on were bundled up and sold as AAA-rated investments to some of the shrewdest investors in the world. Now, if I would
have... But that's different from thinking that you're going to get, you know, 10 to 12% on your money over and over again numerous times a week. I mean,
well, Judge,
up to these
phenomenal
rates of return.
That is a misstatement in the government's position. The underlying agreements provide that no trades that would earn less than 11% would ever be made. So in other words, they wouldn't make trades unless they could guarantee 11%. And that is a representation in the record that also comes from Eldridge. We know from the testimony of Montana that Lytle told Montana that through the connections of Eldridge at DLJ, they were able to purchase these debt instruments at a value less than market and then resell them. But the point is not looking in hindsight. The point is, was there enough evidence in the record for a jury to conclude that, like these investors, these people had $1 million. They were not simpletons. They knew
what the government said in its brief that you had not presented any evidence to suggest that your clients actually believed what Eldridge told them. Is that correct?
Well, you know, I'm not sure how to answer that. I believe we have, Judge. I believe that the testimony was in the
testimony by whom?
The testimony in the first instance by the investors was that we told the investors.
No, but what is the evidence that you believed what you told the investors? Not you personally, obviously.
Well, I think the evidence is their conduct.
I don't understand that.
How
can the fact that you make fraudulent statements show that you believe them?
The fact that they were taking money, that if they were looking to defraud the investors, they wouldn't have sent it to Angela Eldridge. They would have disappeared. They would have left the country.
No, they trusted
everything Eldridge said.
Yeah, but they trusted her to be square in the splitting of the swag. It wasn't that they thought the thing had worked. There's no indication of that.
But there was testimony that when they met with the investors, they said, we believe it's going to work. There were delays. And ultimately, and this is...
What's the evidence they believe? Are you saying none of the money, they didn't get any of the money?
They did.
Everything went to Eldridge?
No, Judge. I am not. I want to be clear.
So they got some money.
They did.
So again, why does the fact that they sent some money to Eldridge show that they believed what she told them?
It wasn't some money. It was the overwhelming majority of the money. And Scienter is negated subsequently when...
The whole theory is that she's the kingpin of this fraud. Well, then it makes sense that they would be sending her most of the money, right? She's the kingpin. That was true even if they're committing fraud. So I don't see why that's evidence that they believed these representations.
Because this wasn't... The theory of the government in this case is not a conspiracy. It's that there are these two independent fraudulent schemes that just happen to coincide perfectly. The government got a judgment against Eldridge for defrauding the defendants in this case.
Your time has expired, Mr. Greenberg, so I'll have to listen to Mr. Paik. Mr. Paik?
May it please the Court, my name is Christopher Pack, and I represent the United States Securities and Exchange Commission in this matter. I would like to start out by addressing several issues I believe were misstated by Mr. Greenberg. First, it is not true that the Commission did not cite the record at all. The Commission cited to the District Court's order only as to those issues that are not disputed. As to the one issue that is disputed, namely whether the defendants had scienter, the Commission scrupulously avoided citing to the District Court's order and instead cited to evidence in the record, namely the Zawistowski report and the agreement between Lytle and Eldridge, both of which are in the record. And those citations can be found at pages 10 and 11 of our brief. The Commission did not... desire to rely solely on the district court order for any disputed issue. Second, the defendants were not precluded from by the district court from producing or citing any evidence to the district court with regard to the Sienter issue. They could have introduced affidavits or testimony of investors, experts. They did not. They had taken the Fifth, so of course they couldn't introduce their own testimony. That would not have prevented them from attempting to introduce other testimony, and they didn't do that. It is also incorrect to state that the misrepresentations the Commission alleged came solely from Eldridge. There was one major misrepresentation that did not come from Eldridge, and that, of course, was a misrepresentation as the diversion of funds. The defendants represented to investors that their monies would be placed in a special trading program or put up for investment. That was that misrepresentation was false because the defendants diverted approximately 25% of the $32 million that they collected from investors to their own uses. This money was not put into any investment program, fictitious or otherwise. And this defendants can hardly deny that they lack scienter with regard to what they did with the funds, these funds that went into their own bank accounts.
Is it your position that once you've proven scienter, for example, as to that, all the rest of it's just icing on the cake?
Well, we certainly think that this is not a minor misrepresentation, obviously. And we think this misrepresentation, standing alone, would be sufficient to justify all the relief the district court ordered, the injunctive relief and the penalties and the disgorgement. And we think because this particular misrepresentation that's not disputed in any regard is so significant that it would justify a complete affirmance of what the district court did here without any need for a remand.
But we don't have any signal from the district court to that effect. She actually goes through all of this evidence.
No, certainly the district court did not address the issue of whether one misrepresentation would be sufficient in and of itself to stand alone. So I can see that the court might desire to order a remand. I doubt that that would be a very productive use of the district court's time, but I can understand why this court might feel that to be necessary. Such a remand, though, should not be made, even if it was thought that the misrepresentation as to diversion of funds may or may not be sufficient to justify the relief here. Such a remand should not be made because the defendants have utterly failed to show any reason to reverse the district court's findings with regard to the other misrepresentations. I'll call them the Eldridge misrepresentations. Defendants claim now that they got them from Eldridge. That's not supported in the record. But leaving that issue aside...
Now, how do they, aside from through attorneys' arguments, it's certainly not from their own testimony, as you point out, because they took the Fifth. And I guess it would be interesting to know, you know, did Ms. Eldridge launch them and did they then embellish along the way, or did she transmit to them by email or otherwise a script that they followed to the letter? I mean, how is, in fact, this link shown or not shown?
Well, it's not shown at all. We don't know what she told them. We know that they had meetings, and we don't dispute that there were meetings between Eldridge and the defendants. What was said at those meetings is a complete black box as far as we are concerned. The defendants haven't testified, obviously. Eldridge hasn't testified. Conceivably, we could find out what went on at these meetings from sources other than Eldridge or the defendants. Perhaps there were other attendees at the meeting, and such people could show up and say, well, I heard Eldridge say X, Y, and Z to the defendants.
What about now, this Mr. Marvin?
That's right. There was Mr. Marvin. However, defendants have failed to call Mr. Marvin as witness, failed to produce any affidavits or declarations or testimony of any kind from any attendee at these meetings, aside from themselves. And so they simply failed to carry their burden. The commission carried its burden when it put up the Zawistowski declaration as to the Eldridge. It's the commission's burden as to the Eldridge misrepresentations. The commission carried its burden when it put forth the Zawistowski declaration, which set forth evidence that, in fact, no reasonable person could have believed these misrepresentations. At that point, the commission had made its initial case, and the burden shifted to the defendants to show, either to impeach Zawistowski, show he wasn't qualified, introduce an expert of their own, or introduce some testimony as to their own beliefs. I mean, for instance, maybe someone said to his minister, I heard these things from Eldridge, and then the minister could get up and say, well, as of such and such a date, Mr. Lytle or Mr. Knight told me that he had heard these things from Eldridge and that he believed them. That would be a testimony that conceivably could create a tribal issue of fact. There's a complete absence of any such testimony here. So, to recapitulate, the commission put forth its case. The defendants utterly failed to respond in any way except through unsworn contentions contained in the brief to the commission's case. Therefore, there is no genuine issue of tribal fact.
Commission does have the burden of proof on scienter.
Of course, but the commission carried that burden by citing the Sosaski report and also the agreement between Lytle and Eldridge, which doesn't contain any provision for insurance whatsoever. Lytle told the investors indirectly that these investments were insured. But you look at the agreement which purportedly governed his relationship with Eldridge, and there's no provision for insurance. Mm-hmm. Once the commission put forth this evidence, the burden shifted to the defendants to show that they have some contrary evidence. And they simply don't have any. Opposing counsel stated that summary judgment would be appropriate only in an extreme and an exceptional case. And I submit that even if that were an accurate characterization of the law, this is an extreme and an exceptional case where defendants have failed to produce any evidence whatsoever. And in our brief, we discussed the evidence they do cite doesn't go to the point at all, doesn't show the substance of what Eldridge told them. In fact, the evidence, the discussions Eldridge had with Marvin, which they cite in their brief, were with regard to a completely unrelated topic, this organization that Eldridge claimed that she'd started up with Newt Gingrich. Had nothing to do, they may have had something tangential to do, but they had, were not, those stories that she told Marvin about Newt Gingrich had no direct bearing on this trading program. Except insofar as they may have bolstered her credibility with Marvin.
Hard to imagine, but anyway.
Anyway, my point is that you can search the briefs here, and there is simply no evidence which a fact finder could consider if trial were held in this case. A trial would merely involve Zawistowski getting up on the stand, and I presume the defendants taking the fifth once again, and no fact finder could reach a conclusion contrary to the one the district court reached here.
Thank you.
Court's permission, I'll conclude. Thank you.
Mr. Greenberg, your time has expired. You can have another minute if you'd like.
Thank you, Judge. I just want to be clear that we, in our brief, have cited to admissible evidence in the record to substantiate each and every assertion that's made in this brief. While the defendants did, in fact, invoke the Fifth Amendment during this case, they testified before the SEC commission, before the SEC fully under oath, and the SEC itself has relied on that testimony. Furthermore, we rely on other deposition testimony. That's entirely proper. There's no rule that the defendants must submit a declaration to overcome summary judgment. And as to one other critical point, the key here is, did they take this money? Yes, some money ended up in their hands. But on that point, the district judge herself indicated that she had less than a lot of confidence in that. She said, however, in our view, the record before us does not support entry of an order of disgorgement or prejudgment interest as penalties. The evidence adduced thus far accounts for only a portion of the investor funds in terms of how much was improperly or fraudulently drawn by any particular defendant. She subsequently has a hearing on this, and at the hearing, the SEC admits that they overinflated what they believe was misappropriated by almost $1 million. So what we have here is not whether you believe the connection with Newt Gingrich. And it's important to note that...
You'll have your time. Is
okay. I appreciate your time.
So thank you very much to both counsel. Next case...